Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Very pleased to be with you here in January, which is Sanctity of Human Life Month. Used to only be Sanctity of Human Life Week, but now there are so many angles to the sanctity experience and message, we have extended it to a whole month, which is a good thing, and we're very happy to celebrate that here this week, especially on The Boundless Show. Later on in the show, we'll have Candace Waters here, and she's going to be answering a listener question about a relationship, a girl who's in a relationship with a guy and is wondering if it really is going to go the distance. So listen in for that. And then our culture segment is with Leah Cangelosi. She is going to tell her own story of her experience with abortion and the healing, the walk, really, walk of healing through that and what God has done in her life as a result. And here I am right now for our roundtable with two wonderful women. I have Carrie Earle and Dawn McBain with me. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, Lisa.
Very great to have you here.
Good to be here.
These ladies are two of our experts in the realm of sanctity issues. Carrie is a senior director with Citizen Link, which is actually now what would we describe it as? An affiliate of Focus on the Family?
It is. It's the policy arm of Focus on the Family.
Mm-hmm. Policy arm of Focus. And Dawn, also part of Citizen Link, but you know her best for heading up Rising Voice through Citizen Link, and she's one of our bloggers. We love seeing her smiling face on the blog and her words of wisdom mm-hmm. for us. You probably just read her recent blog post, A Sanctity of Life Ethic, which was very, very good, a good word for all of us. Really is a worldview, I think, word for us as we approach this month and the issues that we're reflecting on. So, well, I had to bring you guys into the studio because you know stuff that we don't know, and we need kind of some updates from you as we are in this month and really heading into this year, 2012. And like I said, we will be in the next segment talking to a girl who's very personally experienced abortion and really the ramifications of that and her own decisions. And so I kind of want to pull back a few thousand feet and kind of talk about the issues related here kind of in a more general sense, but really how we can really think well, I think, on these issues and think biblically. And so the first thing I want to talk about, I think, in general is, as we're looking at young adults, you know, we talk to young adults here on the show, and of course, Rising Voice does as well. We're kind of, you know, years and years and years, four decades now past Roe v. Wade and what's happened there. And we've really seen, as I said in the front end of the show, the life issue expand to now human trafficking, orphan care, elder abuse and elder care and all that's involved there. Some in our audience are just exhausted. We have not, I mean, our audience has not grown up without Roe v. Wade and without this discussion and without, how do we combat fatigue when it comes to this issue and just feeling overwhelmed about mm-hmm. what can we do, what has happened, what hasn't happened, and where do we go from mm-hmm. here?
Well, I think you have to start with why you care. And we care about these issues not only because we're human beings and we live on the planet with other human beings, but because we're Christians. And we know that we are made in the image of God, Genesis 1. He made us in his image. He made us male and female. So I battle the fatigue, and I've been at this for 20 plus years, by focusing on who God is, making sure that I am plugged into him to communicate to those around me why I care. And I care because I'm made in his image. And as part of that, I'm called to bear his image, and I'm called to declare his image. And I'm called to defend his image. And if you just are walking with Christ, having that fellowship, having that unceasing worship with him, you are bearing his image and you're celebrating in it. Then as you're interacting with people at the coffee shop or at school or at work, you are declaring his image. Sometimes you may be called to defend his image, and that would mean to come into the public square with some kind of social engagement, and we'll talk about that. But I think the best way to fight the fatigue and the exhaustion and just feeling overwhelmed about it is to focus on who he is and to celebrate we are made in his image. What an amazing thing that those that you are around every day bear the image of the living God. And if we just thought about that for a minute, how is that possible? I mean, I'm not saying we're all little deities and we should go around and bow to each other, but we should have a sense of respect and awe, not only to love ourselves made in God's image, but to love God as well.
Mm-hmm. So if we were all perfect, which we're not, we would do this very well, and we would be gaining all kinds of ground, and we would be loving people, not only within this issue, but into the kingdom and everywhere. But what have we not done well in the last few decades, and what have we done well, and how do we know what to focus on specifically?
I think, like you said, Lisa, that there really is that fatigue, the thought of there are so many different areas here that you could get involved in. As Carrie said, not only thinking about who God is with this issue, but also thinking about what God has called us to. God has given us each a unique calling on our lives, and to think through how has God made me and how has God wired me to reach out to a hurting and a hopeless and a lost world, and to find those little areas. You know, I find myself constantly convicted in how I drive and in how I communicate. You know, someone's not being as efficient as I would like them to be at the checkout counter, and really being able to reach out to those people, showing God's love and allowing God to work through me in those areas, and to really think about a sanctity of life in those really practical, tangible, small ways, and then live a sanctity ethic in those ways.
Hmm. So where would you say we are now, for example, culturally? When we look at entertainment, when we look at the media, it seems like we gain a couple steps here and then there's something that just slays us and we're all discouraged. And, you know, I think of, you know, we saw some relatively good themes show up in the movie Juno, and then we saw Kourtney Kardashian decide to keep her baby, and that's exciting. And she's, you know, talked about that very well in the wake of that, of just, oh, I'm so glad I kept this baby. But then we see a lot of decisions that aren't great. Where do we really see hearts turning in this sphere?
You know, I think we see them a lot in the personal connections. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing some in the entertainment culture really turning away from that more pro-abortion mindset. And it's because we've seen the impact. You know, the millennial generation, we talk about this a lot with Rising Voice. We've seen the impact of abortion. We have siblings that are missing, friends that are missing, friends that have gone through abortion, and we see the heartache there. And I think there's that really heart-wrenching perspective that we're having to live through. So I think we're seeing some really positive things with that. I think one of the negative areas we're seeing is because this issue has become so broad, and we have the sex trafficking and the clean water and the concern over genocide, and those are all such good things. But I think sometimes we lack that basic comprehensive worldview that says, if we're concerned about sex trafficking, and we should be, we need to think through how does that impact what we think of abortion, how we vote for candidates from city council all the way up to the president of the United States, and are we willing to sacrifice our values because a candidate might appeal to us in some certain way? Or are we really going to look at this and say, you know, the reason that I have a heart for women and children who are victims of sex trafficking is because I believe that these people are made in the image of God, and I care about the humans that are behind these horrible, awful things. And then to really think through that carefully on every level, on abortion, on voting, on that broad scheme of what it means to have a sanctity of life ethic. And I think that's something that my generation, that millennials, could really stand to do a little improving on.
Mm-hmm. So if we're sitting here and we're just saying, okay, I think I care about all this stuff, but I don't even know where to start, and I'm not even sure if I can enter a discussion that makes me even sound rational, or, you know, or maybe someone will say, oh, I just love the elderly, or I'm really passionate about orphans, or I really do care about my friend who had an abortion and I want to get involved in some kind of a crisis pregnancy situation or ministry. What are the next steps? How does someone go about just tackling either information or application when it comes to this?
Well, there are a lot of good resources. Here at Focus on the Family and Citizen Link, we have in-depth as well as lighter level resources. So you can come to our websites. Dawn's website, Rising Voice, has a whole section that deals with issues. So I'd say the first thing is, you know, get before the Lord and see where your heart is, then start to become educated on it. You will be amazed at the opportunities that God will just open the door and put you in the path. And don't feel like you've got to take the whole world on. This is a marathon. Jesus came to give us abundant life. Till he returns, our enemy, the devil, comes to steal, kill, and destroy. So this is a long-term battle. This isn't something that's going to be solved in our lives, and we need to run it like a marathon and not get worn out like a sprint.
Mm-hmm. You know, we kind of talk straight here at Boundless, and sometimes we just tell people, basically we tell them what to do. We just tell them.
We never do that. We tell them. Yeah.
We tell them what they need to know and what they need to do, and we're not ashamed to do that. But you know, and I already alluded to the fact that after this segment, we're going to be talking to a girl who, for whom abortion was very real, and it was a decision, and here she was a pastor's daughter and was faced with that decision. There are a number of Christian women out there who are facing unplanned pregnancies. And despite all that they know, and despite all these True Love Waits campaigns and all these purity rings and all this stuff that everyone's signing and everyone's talking about and everyone's going on marches and stuff like that, these women are still getting pregnant and now they're still choosing abortion. Where is the disconnect?
Well, as long as you have legal abortion, Lisa, we're going to have women becoming pregnant unintentionally and having abortions. Where there's a demand, there'll be a market. Where there's a market, there'll be a demand. Those two go hand in hand. I think the abortion issue in the church continues to be evidence of a lax sexual ethic. If we are living in a way that we are living out our faith in our relationships and we're true to sexual purity until marriage, guess what? We're not going to end up pregnant. I mean, unless there is something really unexpected that happens. My own story was a minister's daughter, very much like the lady you're going to hear from, became pregnant at a Christian college. Should have known better, was sleeping with my boyfriend. I had an abortion. I mean, so I understand the woman who's there. I'm not speaking from a place of judgment, I'm speaking from a place of I've been there. But I know that if I had been living true to my faith and had been living in sexual purity until marriage, I would have saved myself a ton of heartache and I wouldn't have been one of those statistics. So until I think, you know, we as Christian men and women own up to what Jesus has called us to do, which is for our good. It's not just because he's a fuddy-duddy who doesn't want us to, you know, have sex. He designed it in that marriage relationship for a reason. And it is disappointing and it's heartbreaking to see that. I wish the churches would talk more about the issue. You know, yes, to talk about abortion and to talk compassionately, because there are women in the pews that have had abortions like me, but also to talk forthrightly about the power of your sexuality, keeping yourself pure. What are the benefits of that? Dating people who have the same values that you do and not being led astray by that. So I think until the church speaks a little louder and clearer and we're listening, we're going to have Christian women having abortion.
Mm-hmm. And is willing to be in, you know, we always talk about this, the fact that we just need people in our business. You know, we're so silent on this stuff and unwilling to, oh, well, I don't want to ruffle feathers, or I don't want to speak to that, or maybe I don't have enough of a relationship. You know, I mean, it's like when you hear all these stories on the back end of just, I wish I would have known, I wish someone would have walked me through it, I wish someone would have held my hand and showed that to me. I think really, like you said, truth balanced with compassion is so critical here. Okay, well, let's talk. We are in the middle of, would you say it's the middle of an election furor, or
beginning? I'd say by the presidential politics, we're all tired and done, but that's another
I can tell if we're on the front end, the middle, or where we are. I just feel like, you know, people are dropping like flies and what's happening. But let's talk about what is at stake this time around. What do we need to know heading into the next round of elections?
Well, it is an important year. We're electing a president. We're electing a third of the U.S. Senate. We're electing the full House of Representatives, state legislatures across the nation, governors. There are ballot issues. 2012 is a huge year. I am cognizant and sympathetic to some degree when people hear the word politics or elections. They start to coil up. I mean, they just don't want anything to do with it. But when you think about your calling as a Christian, your calling to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, that is only possible in this nation because of the religious freedoms that we have. And those are not ones to be taken for granted. How we protect those is to be registered to vote, to be an informed voter, to go to the polls, even if it's just in the November general election, to do that. You know, Christians have a long history of social engagement, from starting orphanages and churches to ending slavery. There is a calling that the Lord has on our lives in this nation. There are people in China who don't have the freedoms we have, and this is how we keep them, is to be involved. So know your issues, know what you care about, and vote for candidates that support that. But we have to be proactive and intentional to keep that freedom of religion, if you will, if we want to continue to have the ability to proclaim Christ in the culture.
Hmm. Yeah, it's so true. And I think it just amazes me when I look at where people are getting their information, whether it is, you know, in the public policy sphere or whether it's for their own personal situation. I mean, I just Googled abortion help or should I get an abortion? And I mean, there's a WikiHow for it. I mean, seriously, like you're just supposed to look at a 2-minute video and make this decision. I mean, there are women asking questions on Yahoo Answers, like, you know, right next to should I go to Vegas or Orlando for my vacation? Should I get an abortion? I mean, ridiculous. And, you know, when it comes to legislation and public policy stuff, I mean, people are just throwing out weird opinions on stuff, totally uninformed. So I think what you say is good, Carrie, that we need to really understand where to get our information and how to do that and to think critically and think biblically on these things. And to recognize that if you don't know what you're talking about, find someone who knows what they're talking about. You know, don't be afraid. I always say that, you know, whenever we elect judges, I always have to go after people that I'm like, I don't even know who these people are. So mm-hmm. Can you please just tell me what is going on?
And Facebook isn't generally a good place to find that information.
don't look at other people's notes on Facebook or other things. Yeah, that's probably, nor polls, you know, who has polled what. So, well, in saying that, I would definitely recommend risingvoice.com, citizenlink.com. You guys are going to have a bunch of info up as we head into that. And then let's talk about the flip side of that, just the personal end of it. Where can women and men who are looking at life issues, whether it is, you know, abortion specifically or whether it is orphan care? I mean, I know we have a lot here at Focus, but just what are some of the things that they can engage with on that end?
You know, I think it, just like you had just said, be well informed on these. There is beavoice.net. That's one of Focus on the Families. Great resources for orphan care and for adoption and to really pray and ask the Lord to show you wisdom in where to find good information, because the internet is a wide, wide world of good, bad, and ugly information. So to be intentional and to find the experts in the field that you align with and then kind of look and see where they're pointing people to. There's a lot of really good, solid, Christian-based, intelligent information out there if you're willing to look a little.
Yeah, that's good. And I think just, too, to remember that who we are talking to right now, you out there, you boundless listeners, you are the ones that really can make a difference. You are the ones that are in relationship with young women who are getting pregnant. Whether you are mentoring teens who are getting pregnant or whether these are your friends, your sisters, your whatever, you know, do not rely on our 80-year-old grandmas to be talking about this. I mean, that is, you know, we want them to and we want them to pray and they are doing that. But this is our, I think, our battleground now and our opportunity to speak up and to be heard and to be in relationship with people. So I just want to thank you ladies for kind of being at the forefront of that and providing us the information we need to do that well.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
Hello, everyone. We are here for this week's culture segment, and I am joined on the phone by Leah Cangelosi. Leah, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Very good to have you here. And we found you actually through a friend of a friend, one of our friends who works for Justice for All, who mentioned you as someone whose story might resonate with our listeners and would be a good one to tell as we celebrate Sanctity of Human Life Month here at Boundless and at Focus on the Family, and really nationally and within the Christian community especially. Of course, we just came off of a discussion with Carrie and Dawn about really what this issue looks like, the national face of it right now as we're heading into elections and beyond. But your story is very personal, and this puts a face to what many women deal with when they're faced with an unplanned pregnancy. And I know you shared with me on the front end a little bit of your story, and so I want you to be able to tell that to our listeners. And it really begins, you know, it's there's so many common, it seems, threads and patterns when we hear stories like this. Your story began with divorce, that of your parents, and you talked to me about sitting down with both your parents in your living room. You were about 5 years old, right?
Yes, I was five.
Yeah, 5 years old, and your dad was a pastor, and basically the announcement came that your parents were divorcing. When you were a senior in high school, then you started dating a guy who was actually a Christian, and thus began kind of that journey. So let's go ahead and kind of pick up there, Leah, with kind of where you were in high school, your senior year. Like you said, it was kind of really your first real boyfriend, I guess, and kind of what your expectations were there and what happened.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of times if someone would hear where my story ended up, people would probably think that the relationship that I was in high school would have been quite different. And there was nothing, I think, at that time for a high school relationship. You know, it's so easy to feel like it's so serious, kind of your first puppy love. And I think there was nothing super dysfunctional about that relationship. We were two young people both from loving Christian families. His parents actually are pastors as well, so we were kind of the two preacher's kids. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, there was such a deep just need to feel chosen. And I think that's the case for many young women and young girls at that age. And I think in some ways this relationship provided that. And without even realizing or thinking about a plan for our relationship physically, sitting down and talking about those are things that weren't even at the forefront of my mind. I was definitely kind of letting what I thought my heart and my emotions lead me. And we began to get pretty serious. And along with that, I had never been physical with anyone before. I had pretty much remained pure, and that was kind of the somewhat goal that I had in my mind for that relationship. But very quickly, it turned physical. And not realizing at that point what I was really giving away, does that make sense, at that time, not realizing that I was giving more than just my body, but my heart and my emotions, and not realizing the connections, the deep, lasting connections that I was making at that point. So that was really kind of, as far as the relationship goes, where we were at. He moved to Texas after we graduated high school and got a football scholarship. He came from a big football family, and so there was always a lot of expectation for him to perform out on the field. And I began to drive on the weekends, every weekend, to see him. And I think it was that freedom of being alone that kind of got us into trouble. Mm-hmm. And it was that first semester that he was started school that I found out I was pregnant.
Okay. And I know, like you said, it's easy to get caught up in the relationship and caught up in those feelings, and you know, it just kind of like how that slippery slope kind of mm-hmm. begins, you know, in the sense mm-hmm. of here you said you kind of knew in your head. And I know you when you were describing your story to me, you talked about looking at that True Love Waits card on your wall and taking mm-hmm. it down, and just the sense of shame you had in the sense mm-hmm. of feeling like a failure mm-hmm. in the midst of that. And obviously, as is so often the case, and you can continue to pick up the story here, that relationship, you find out you're pregnant, and then where did it go from there as far as his involvement in the relationship?
Oh, definitely. It's one of those moments that I call a time stood still kind of moment. You never imagine yourself in that situation. I think, especially at that age, it's so easy to think it'll never happen to me. And immediately, I felt panicked. He began to panic. Everything that, even just spiritually, morally, that I feel like I was so grounded in for so many years of my life became unknown. And I remember calling him the night that I took the pregnancy test, and there's kind of this automatic expectation that we're going to be a happy family, and he's going to want to be there, and he's going to want to be a dad, and he's going to be, you know, he's going to fall in love with me, and we're going to get married, and kind of that fairy tale ending. And that wasn't what happened. That wasn't the response that I got. He hung up the phone, and I remember when we got off the phone that night, it kind of ended in a point of where he was trying to decide if he wanted to even be involved in the situation, in the decision-making, or even be there for me. And that was when I kind of feel like everything was pulled out from underneath me. And just to speak on the guilt and the shame, I think the biggest fear that I had was disappointing my parents and disappointing my church family and those around me. And that was my first thought, was how am I ever going to recover from this?
Yeah. Well, and it's not like you only had to deal with that. I mean, so you had the pregnancy, but then what we hear from so many women is just that sense of rejection when any relationship ends, because it did mm-hmm. go south and it did end up breaking up. And so now you're reeling from basically the father of your child walking out and saying, I'm not going to enter into this situation. I'm not going to be part of it. And you have to deal with your heart being hurt from that, at the same time dealing with now you have a pregnancy and where are you going to go from there? So tell us kind of what happened in the wake of that.
Well, I waited a while to tell anyone about my pregnancy other than my best friend that was with me at the time. And I don't know what it was. There was something inside of me. I had been raised very pro-life my whole life. I remember standing out on the curb during Life Change Sunday, which is an event here that we do, and all the churches come together and hold out pro-life signs. And I remember that. And that was something that my parents instilled in me at an early age. So abortion was something that I think I probably thought about for about 2 seconds. And then I just felt like I knew in my heart that I was going to have that baby. So I then sat down and told my sister, actually, and her response was wonderful. She accepted me and embraced me, and that really gave me the strength to sit down and tell my parents. My dad was, that was probably one of the hardest conversations I've ever had to have. He was very quiet. Didn't say anything. In fact, his response to me was, after sitting there in silence, was, well, I guess you'll have to eat your vegetables now. Yeah. But in that moment, I knew that in some form, that was his way of telling me that it was going to be okay and he loved me. On the other hand, during all of this, my boyfriend did, in fact, call me. And like you said, it was so hard because I wasn't just dealing with the pregnancy, but I was also dealing with this relationship where we were broken up off and on throughout the entire pregnancy, and so there was no consistency there. But his family, actually, their initial response was very loving and accepting. But then a couple of weeks later, it was his mom actually took my mother out for dinner and attempted to talk her into trying to get me to have an abortion. And that was really painful. And it got to a point where that kept being pushed. And I finally had to walk into her office. And we have a wonderful relationship now, but at the time it was very rocky. And she can be an intimidating woman. And I walked in, and I remember having to look her in the face at one point. She was telling me, "Do you know how people are going to look at you? And this is going to ruin his football career and his school. And he, you know, you need to be kids." And I just remember having to look at her and say, "This baby's going to be given a chance to live just like you are." And those were that was kind of a moment for me where I think my choice was really made. And so that's kind of how I came to the point where I knew that that's what I was going to do, is continue the pregnancy.
Okay. And so you did, and you did give birth to your little baby.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you realized pretty much that you would be in this alone, I guess, at that point. And I know you were still dealing with the ramifications of the breakup, and in that you became a mom, but really started a downward spiral at the same time, having to wrestle with feelings of, you know, surrounding self-worth and your identity and what all that entailed, and where you were in your situation. And just describe that downward spiral a bit, and then really where that led into the next part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, my son's father actually is in my son's life, which is wonderful. We were off and on. We kept trying to repair that relationship over and over, kind of like beating a dead horse at some point. But there was a point where we just knew that we were going two different directions, and the relationship, not the co-parenting relationship, but the romantic relationship, was over. And I think that's when I realized I had put so much of my self-worth into him. And then the void was left when that relationship ended, the void of not knowing who I was, completely forgetting about my worth in God. I was lost. I began nursing school, and for the first time in a long time, I had friends, because I had been so isolated to being a single mom and working full-time and trying to just have that serious relationship. That was my whole focus, that I didn't really have much of a social outlet. So these girls that I was going to school with in nursing school became my friends, and they were exciting, and that was something that kind of filled a temporary void for me. So I began going out with them, and the types of activities that we would do together would really be centered around partying. And that kind of became my life. I would go to school and do clinicals and work full-time and take care of my son. And at the time, I was staying with my mother. And when he would go to sleep, I would go out, and that would be my life.
Yeah, just kind of a cycle, I think you would say, of partying, drinking, kind of being in with the wrong crowd. And like you said, kind of sustaining that life on the side, while at the same time keeping up with, you know, with what you had to do as far as responsibilities during the day. So that led to kind of a fateful night. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the night that I had actually had a phone conversation with my son's dad, and, you know, it was kind of that final moment where I came to the realization that there was no chance of us working out. My friends, you know, thought the perfect remedy would be to go out. So we went out to a club one night and went dancing, and afterwards we went to an after party at my friend's apartment. And there were so many different people there. And looking back, it amazes me now how much I opened myself up to people that I didn't even know, just in hopes, I think, for acceptance. And again, just that affirmation and trying to find my self-worth. And so there were a lot of different guys that I had talked to that night. And but I just got to a point where I was so depressed, I just wanted to go to bed. So I had been drinking that night, and I think I actually even took a sleeping pill or something that night, and I had decided to go upstairs and go to sleep. And I remember being woken up, and one of the guys that had been at the party that had repeatedly kind of tried to talk to me throughout the night was on top of me. And it was kind of one of those moments where, an out-of-body moment where you kind of see it happening to you, and it, and in that moment it doesn't feel real, but it was one of the most traumatic things I've ever experienced. And I remember even in that moment somehow feeling like I deserved that, and I think a lot of young women feel that way, despite the fact that I knew there was something being taken away from me, and that I was being violated in that moment. And I tried to fight him off, but there was no way I could. And he had threatened me during that time that if I told anyone, you know, he'd come back and find me, and he knew where I lived, and he knew my son. And so I was pretty silenced by that fear. And in that moment, I just felt numb. And I remember getting up that morning and leaving and not saying a word to anyone about what happened.
Yeah. So really a night of, you know, what began with partying, and then you pass out, you wake up and really discover that you are being raped by a guy that you had met earlier, but had kind of, you know, held off his advances. And like you said, the conversations you'd had. Fast forwarding out of that situation, you discover that in the wake of this, you are actually pregnant again. I mean, unbelievably, from one encounter with this guy. I mean, I don't know why I say unbelievably. We should all know what can happen. But it really, I mean, truly, when you look at the odds and that this happened, and I know you said you were just stunned to see the pregnancy test, and now you are again faced with an unplanned pregnancy, and had some decisions to make, and maybe pick it up a little bit right there.
Yes, and that is when I decided I must be the most fertile person in the world, because it was one of those moments where I never would have even guessed. I started throwing up about, I guess, a month or so after it happened, and I just thought that I was sick and I had a virus, and I became very sick, and just something in the back of my mind said, well, I'm going to take this pregnancy test just to rule it out. And I remember calling my friend and telling her to meet me at a gas station, and I took the test, and immediately two lines showed up. And my heart dropped. I became so afraid. The situation this time was completely different in my mind than the situation the first time. At least that was my perception. And I was so afraid that no one was going to believe me, or that my family was going to kick me out, or that my son's dad's family was going to, you know, stop seeing him. I mean, just the amount of fear that entered into my mind at that point was unbelievable and overwhelming.
Yeah, exactly. And you said, I know that you basically moved forward then through the process of justifying really to yourself. I mean, you talked about having an internal dialogue with really what this meant and saying, well, this guy, I didn't know it was done in rape. I mean, maybe this is something I can't handle the second time around. And really walking through to the point where you decided, faced with the situation again, that you were going to go ahead with an abortion this second time around. And talk to us a little bit, Leah, about, I know, you know, going to the clinic and just all those second thoughts that you had and really battling against those to go through with this decision. And what would you say was, you know, as you look back on that experience, what really was most kind of that seminal decision in your head as you really kind of made the difference between this situation and your previous one?
Mm-hmm. I think the difference was, again, my fear of acceptance. A lot of it's easy on the outside to see someone facing an unplanned pregnancy, even when it is a result of rape. And I've heard a lot of people say, specifically pro-life supporters, say that, well, selfishness is the key reason that young women choose abortion. In my experience personally, and with the many women that I've been given the opportunity to counsel, I almost see fear as the biggest catalyst in that choice a lot of times. I did not want to have an abortion. It was odd that I was making this choice that was hurting my heart, and I knew morally what I was doing, but I literally felt paralyzed by the idea of I cannot tell my parents I'm pregnant. I cannot have this baby. I felt like I had no other choice. And so I remember going to the library and looking at pictures of babies and fetuses and embryos and trying to justify that the life wasn't a life. And I knew inside that I was. So I think for me, it was the process of justification that you can bring yourself to in that moment is unbelievable. And, you know, as I had told you, I even had justified that maybe this was God wiping my slate clean and giving me a second chance. And I wanted so badly to believe in those things because they provided a temporary comfort that would allow me to go through with the abortion. And so that's what I chose.
Yeah.
I felt like there was no way out. I felt trapped.
Mm-hmm. And I know you described going through with the abortion and just kind of that whole traumatic experience of, coming out of that and basically being packed off to another room to, quote unquote, recover. And, just the situation surrounding the clinic and what went on there. And no surprise for those who have heard similar stories. But you were faced in the wake of that really with a realization kind of what your decision had been. And so walk us kind of out of that situation a little bit.
Well, and like you said, at the clinic, there was no type of care going on. I didn't feel like I was at a doctor's office being given a gold standard of care that one might expect to have when you go see a doctor. I felt like a number. I felt like just a situation that needed to be taken care of. And again, thrown into a recovery room, left with a numbness. So initially when I walked out the door of the abortion clinic, I felt numb. And I even remember that night putting on my happy face and taking my son to the carnival that was in town. And I just remember being there on the outside, but on the inside I was hurting. And I remember thinking, they have no idea I'm here, and I had an abortion today, and it was a surreal moment. So coming out of that, I think I spiraled into a place where I began to just shove everything down and running further and further from God because I didn't want to face the pain of my choice, the trauma that I had gone through, the rape, and I began to get into an abusive relationship. I began to party more than ever, tried drugs, anything that could self-medicate that pain that I was running from. And that's really kind of the way that I dealt with the abortion at that time.
Mm-hmm. And it really was a process for you then of climbing out and of recognizing, it's so interesting as you tell this how, and I'd like you to speak to women here because we're talking to men and women, many in their college through 30s, women who, there are probably a lot of pastors' kids out there and women who signed their True Love Waits card and who would say to themselves, I would never make that decision. Mm-hmm. And what really, I mean, for you, really, despite all of that, you did still believe the lie and had to climb out of that. What would be your word to women in this situation or ones who may ultimately face that as far as, what truths to believe now and how to, how to face something like this in a way that, will prepare them for that?
Well, I think when I look back at my life and I think the root of, we talk a lot about I work for a pregnancy resource center, and in the counseling room, we talk a lot about the root of the issue of why women choose abortion and then the symptoms. And I see a lot of symptoms in my life story that spoke to potential danger for getting to the place where I was, if that makes sense. And I think the root of those symptoms were what I call a father factor. When my father left, I think there was a void there that I began to try to fill with other things. So for those women, that's so important, is continually hiding yourself in Him and abiding in Him, and throughout that those relationships that are going to come along in your life, remembering who you really are, because that was what I lost sight of. And I think that had a lot to do with bringing me to a point where I got into those situations and ended up in those choices. But one of the things that I see when young women come in who are preachers' daughters, or they've been raised in ministry, their biggest fear is disappointing their parents. And a lot of times they are the ones that, when we sit down and talk with them, they are the most abortion-minded or the most abortion-vulnerable, because they cannot imagine the pain of having to sit down and tell their parents. And so the idea of abortion being this eraser and bringing your life back to the way it was before is a really appealing idea in that moment. But in all reality, it causes more pain and more trauma. So I would say to those women, and what I say to them when we're in those situations, is to really stop and think about how it's going to affect them, and to also encourage them to let go of that fear of approval of man, and to know that God still loves them. He has a plan for their life. He has a plan for their baby. And the beauty that He can bring from this very messy situation is unbelievable.
So true. Well, Leah, as we kind of wrap up here, you know, you alluded to this a bit here as far as really the healing that you found in Christ and how you were able to slowly pray through and walk through this situation. You found a restored relationship with your dad in the midst of this. You were able to get into a ministry of crisis pregnancy. You just talked about that and how you're now able to speak to young women who are going through very similar situations to what you yourself experienced. And in the midst of all this, in 2008, you met and married the guy who's now your husband. You described him as your Hosea. And I want to ask you a tough question in light of that. And that is, I could see women seeing that portion of your story and saying, mm-hmm. How in the world does Leah deserve a husband like this guy? A guy who, in the midst of her brokenness, pursued her. Here she was, you know, she'd gotten pregnant for the first time by a pastor's son, and then she had entered a life of partying and brokenness, and God still, quote unquote, rewarded her with a husband, and here I am with no one to pursue me. What's really your hope for them?
My hope for them is that there's always hope, and that I know that we serve a God of second, third, fourth chances, not to settle. A lot of women, I think, that probably would have made the horrible choices that I made would come to a point where the idea of finding someone probably seems impossible. And so my hope is for them is to remember to God's pursuing them first before any man. And I think I had to come to a place. There were a few guys that I tried to date even after God kind of brought me to a place of healing, and it never worked out. And I think it's because I hadn't completely let go of that need for a man in my life. And once God really, truly became the man in my life, which sounds so cheesy, but it's so true, that's when I feel like I was at a point where I was able to be pursued by a godly man. And my husband, within that, though, there has been a process. It's been painful. My husband's had to walk through that, a lot of those things with me. And, you know, he has a very interesting and messy story as well. And we've had to walk through that together. So it hasn't been perfect. It hasn't been this fairy tale romance. But I know that there's always hope. And God, you know, it's an upside down kingdom. He gives us hope when we don't deserve it, and love when maybe we've made those wrong choices. So that would be my encouragement to them, is to not settle and to not lose hope, because it's possible. If I was so messed up, if He could give me a wonderful husband that I have, then I know that He could do the same for them.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for sharing your story, and we are rooting for you. I know I didn't say this on the front end, but you are now pregnant. You are anticipating the birth of your next child, and we are excited for you, and just thank you for your vulnerability and really sharing your story and the journey you went on and what God taught you in the midst of that, and how, as you said on the front end, He has restored you, and really a story of redemption in the midst of all this. Mm-hmm. And you even described it with that very popular, famous verse, describing it as beauty from ashes, and replacing the despair that you had in your own situation with the hope that only He could bring. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you, Lisa.
Up this week's inbox, and I have Candace with me. Hey, Candace.
Hey, Lisa. How are you?
I am doing well. Good to hear your voice again.
Oh, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
I know. How are all the kids doing?
Right now, they're quiet. Hopefully, that's a good thing.
Okay. That's good. Hopefully, you won't hang up the phone and find out someone has a haircut or something.
Exactly. Or paint on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, quiet can come at a really high price sometimes.
That's true. Well, you are here to answer one of our questions, another relationship question. And so this is going to be good. A girl who wants to know, looks like she's in a relationship and has a couple questions here. So she says,
okay,
I have been in a relationship with a wonderful man for the past 10 months. We attend the same church, have the same beliefs. My family adores him, and I love his family as well. In reality, what more could I ask for? But I'm still terrified. I know marriage is till death do us part, and I don't want to wake up 10 years from now regretting marrying him. Are these doubts I've made on my own because I'm being overly critical, or are we really not meant to be?
Well, they may be just the typical run-of-the-mill, you know, anxiety about making such a big commitment, but it sounds like maybe there's a little bit more there. And two, I want to say that there's definitely a lot of room between, am I just making up doubts, or are we not meant to be? I mean, that's like, you know, the ocean in between those two options. And who's to say if you're quote-unquote meant to be? I think what she needs is an objective standard to measure her relationship against, because her feelings will fluctuate, and she can't really trust her emotions and her gut instinct on whether or not this is a good idea. And that's really true after you've said, I do. There will be days when you wake up and think, I pretty much married the wrong person. And at that point, it is not an option. No, at that point, you married your husband, and so he is the right person for the rest of your life. So I think the starting point is to just suggest that you've got to pull away from looking at just your emotions to make the decision and start looking at an objective standard. And so what is that? Well, ultimately, it is the Bible. It's God's word. And it's what he says about what marriage is and about what a husband's job is and what a wife's job is. And to measure his ability, the man's ability, to step into that role of husband, and then also to be looking into her own heart and seeing if she is willing to take on the job description of wife. Now, Lisa, as our listeners will know, you know, I'm a big fan of doing this in the context of a church community and with the help of a mentor couple, because it's not easy when you're young and in love to often have an objective outlook on your relationship. So look at Ephesians 5. You know, read the passage there where Paul talks about what husband and wife are supposed to be. And the other thing that is so important during this phase of dating is to really work hard to have your eyes wide open, to be resisting the temptation to let your heart go and to just, you know, enjoy all the fun and excitement of the giddy newness of the relationship, because that exciting feeling is temporary. It always goes away. Research has shown that it lasts from between 18 months to 3 years. And so if you're basing your decision on how you feel, you're going to get to the point where you're going to have a crisis. And then I think as far as questions she might ask, you know, okay, so that's sort of the theoretical overview, but here's the practical nitty-gritty. Observe this man that you're dating and discern his trajectory. What is he capable of becoming? What kind of a path is he on? You know, pay attention to things like whether or not he struggles with the internet, either social media and just overuse of the internet or even pornography. And ask him things like, what are you doing to ensure that this will never be a problem for you, ever? What safeguards have you put in place? You know, a man, given that question, asked respectfully, needs to have a satisfactory answer. If he says, oh, well, that's just not a struggle for me, well, then I would say, you know, run for the hills, because it's not true that it's not a struggle for men. And the internet makes it so easy that's just it's nearly impossible for a man to truly not be tempted in that area. So how is he going to protect his future wife and his future children, and how is he going to protect his own purity in this area? Pay close attention to how much time he spends on video games, and ask, you know, is he being a good steward of his time? Is he spending more time studying God's word than he does consuming media? You know, what does he avoid in his life? What does he embrace? And then also, to his character, how does he handle bad news, and how does he act in conflict, and how is he in difficult circumstances? You know, is he a defiant man, or is he coming under the authority of other men, and is he willing to submit to proper authority? Does he worry about worrisome things, or is he a prayer who trusts in the Lord? I think you really have to be looking for clues about who he's going to become as an 85-year-old man. You know, you're not marrying a 21-year-old. You're marrying an 85-year-old man. That you want to be able to look ahead to see who will this man be over the course of his life, because it is a big decision. Mm-hmm. And so this is not the season to be letting your heart go. You know, that will come after, really in the engagement phase. I think once you've made the decision and you're engaged, that's the point where you can really start to enjoy. And then especially after the wedding, that's when you are totally in. And that's when you want to, somebody said, you know, make sure I think it was Dr. Dobson, eyes wide open during dating and then eyes half closed for the rest of your married life together. I think he was sort of joking. But mm-hmm. Anyway, this is the time to ask practical questions. And 10 months is a long time. And if she is still, you know, if they really are on the same page as much as she says, then I think maybe she's just overreacting.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it is a little bit of an emotional response, to which I would like to encourage her just in knowing. I mean, we hear so much of this now, and we've seen a lot of it reflected in research as well, that millennials especially are so determined to have a successful marriage and have a marriage that does not look like their parents, that they are terrified of moving towards marriage. And as a result, that's why we're seeing such high rates of, you know, tragically, yeah, cohabitation and all of that, because they think they're going to practice at it. So, you know, the fear is not unusual probably for her generation, but like you said, to have an objective standard, to have objective people in your life, and to really have godly counsel, I think is so key.
Well, and I think to get rid of that idea that you can know at the front end if you are meant to be, because mm-hmm. that kind of taps into that whole soulmate idea, mm-hmm. and what you just said about these young people who are determined not to have what their parents had, are ending up with nothing because they're delaying marriage so long that a lot of them aren't marrying in time to have families, and you know, they're just encountering so many other problems because of the delay. And I think that's a really good insight.
Sure. Well,
and marriage is work, you know. I mean, you make the best decision you can, and then you work at it with all your heart and all your might, and you pray like crazy, and you know, grow in the Lord together. And that's why it's so important to marry a believer, so that you are both going to the Lord for help in your marriage. But you really can't allow yourself the idea in the back of your head that divorce is an option. You have to engage in your marriage 110%.
Yep. Well, that is it for this week's show. Write to us, editor@boundless.org, so that you can submit a question for the future. And until then, we hope you're catching up on past shows, especially now in the new year, because we have a whole slew of them coming up for you. That is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org, focused on the family.